This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Grateful for being invited to be here. Very happy to be here with you this morning. And I will try and talk up. I kind of love that I was billed as Alberto. More often I go as Albert, but sometimes when I write an email to an old friend like your venerable reverend, I sign it Alberto, and I guess that's how it got picked up. So,
yeah. Was it
advertised? It was Alberto. And, you know, I have various names in various contexts. I guess I could shorten it to Beto and run for office, but I think we'll leave well enough alone. I thought this being sort of the beginning of the year that I would go back to basics, and I want to talk just some very fundamental Zen teaching, and please forgive me if... as is likely, you've heard it all before. But perhaps it'll be helpful. I thought I'd start with the very first case in the Book of Serenity, which is the koan collection, the collection of stories that's most associated with our school, with the Soto school of Zen. The very first case is entitled "The World Honored One Ascends the Seat." World Honored One, spoiler alert, is an epithet for the Buddha. One day, the World Honored One ascended the seat. Manjushri struck the gavel and said, "Clearly observe the Dharma of the King of Dharmas. The King of Dharmas is thus. The Dharma of the King of Dharmas is thus." The World Honored One got down off the seat. So the story functions on two levels. It's... in that sense, my friend and sometimes teacher, Norman Zoketsu, Norman Fisher, points out that it's sort of a postmodern literary event because it comments on itself. The most obvious level is that the Dharma, the truth of reality, is fundamentally indescribable. Zen literature is full of stories about what a mistake it is to try and talk about it. I'm guessing that sometimes you chant the Song of the Jewel Mirror Samadhi that contains the line, "Just to depict it in literary form is to relegate it to defilement." And so the World Honored One, the Buddha, infinitely wise as he was, just got down from the seat. His Dharma was thus. If I was wise, I'd probably quit while I was ahead, particularly since we already chanted the Shinshin Ming, which pretty much contains everything that I'm going to say anyway. But for better or worse, I'm a fool. So I'm going to go on and talk a little more about this story. The other level of this story is that it does describe the indescribable. The truth of reality is that it is thus. The teaching is that the entirety of our lives, including our birth, including our death, is all right here, all of it, complete, unfolding in each moment. Just this is it. It is thus. Which brings to mind a cartoon that made the circles a lot in, 20 years ago, by the cartoonist Gayan Wilson, who used to publish in The New Yorker a lot, sort of a wicked, dark sense of humor. As it happens, he was also a Zen student. The cartoon that I saw posted often at meditation sites was of two monks sitting next to each other, an old, really venerable old monk and a young monk. And the old monk is saying to the young monk, nothing happens next. This is it. And the young monk looks really less than happy to get that news. That's another joke that functions on a couple of levels. Maybe the most obvious level is, what a jip. I thought you'd do some amount of sitting, and you have Kensho, you experience Satori, you gain enlightenment, and everything is different. What's the point of all this practice if things are just as they seem? Well, things are just as they seem. In fact, there is no other way for them to be. But we spend very little time paying attention to what is actually unfolding. Mostly we're thinking of some other place, some other time. We're thinking of what we should be doing, what we did do, what's going to happen, what that person said to me, what I need to do next. And if, we're thinking, if I keep meditating, I'm going to reach some sort of realization. We're somewhere else. This in turn brings to mind the title of a book. I love the title of this book by the author Milan Kundera, someone else who had a lot of currency. About 20 years ago, he wrote a book called The Book of Laughter and Forgetting. It was probably his, The Unbearable Lightness of Being, I think, was his most famous one. Mm-hmm. He even made a movie out of it. So he wrote a book called Life is Elsewhere. And, I don't know about you, but for me, that title really so captures kind of my mental state, I'm always thinking that I'm here, I'm doing this, but something really important needs to be attended to somewhere else. My real life is going to happen somewhere else. Life is elsewhere. I loved the title so much, I got the book, and I was traveling in the Czech Republic. Kundera is a Czech writer, and I thought, this is the perfect time to read this book. And so I opened it up, and in the author's introduction, he says, I hated this title. This wasn't my title. The publisher made me use this title. So I didn't actually make it through the book. The point being that we are constantly missing what Suzuki Roshi called things as it is. Things as it is. Things as it is thus. So, despite what the impression that the young monk had in the Gayan Wilson cartoon, there is practice and there is realization. But what's realized from practice is things as it is. What is realized is that the Dharma of the King of Dharmas is thus. just this. There's a verse that goes, you know, these koans have like, they're these neat little stories, but they have all this commentary around them and poems attached to them. The verse that goes with this poem is, "The unique breeze of reality. Do you see it? Continuously, creation runs her loom and shuttle, weaving the ancient brocade, incorporating the forms of spring. But nothing can be done about Manjushri's leaking. The unique breeze of reality. Do you see? Continuously, creation runs her loom and shuttle, weaving the ancient brocade, incorporating the forms of spring. But nothing can be done about Manjushri's leaking." Manjushri, as probably most of you know, is the embodiment of wisdom. So if he can leak, I guess it's okay for me to keep talking. Personally, I don't see, I'm getting into deep water here, I don't see enlightenment as some magic transformation that occurs elsewhere. I have faith that realizing the true nature of reality is always available to us. Right here. Like the old monk said, this is it. So the question that I've been carrying for myself for a long time is, what's stopping me? What is keeping me from living in the unique breeze of reality? From seeing things as it is? What is stopping us from living in the truth? And I guess on the simplest level, it's just habit. Buddhist psychology teaches that for everything that we experience, there is what's called a vedana, a feeling tone. The teaching is that that feeling tone, when we encounter it, when we encounter a thing, we have a response. The feeling tone is either pleasant or unpleasant or neutral. Notice that. Pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. I still haven't really worked out whether it's that simple, but that's the teaching, and I think it's good, at least provisionally. I mean, that's how we're wired, and it's fine that we're wired that way, that we have that response to all of our experiences. The problem is what we do with that information. The basic teaching of Buddhism is that we're in the grip of three poisons of greed, hate, and delusion, of grasping, aversion, and unconsciousness. So we're constantly either trying to get what we want, what we think will make us happier, trying to avoid what we don't like, or we're just plain asleep. These habitual responses are awfully hard to shake, but the ancients promised that letting go of these habits is the path to liberation. We chanted it, the Shinshin Ming. It's classically translated as, "The great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences." I like much better the version that we chanted this morning. "The great way is not difficult for those who are not attached to their preferences." Because being human means that we have preferences. They come up. We will have preferences. The practice is about letting them come up and letting them go. And for me, that's the great lesson of the physicality of Zazen. Experiencing the discomfort of sitting still and learning that I don't have to react to it. I can just sit there. My knees or my thighs are really hurting, and I don't have to respond to it. Cautionary note, you have to really make sure that you're not actually hurting yourself. But you can do a lot of just letting those muscles expand, and it hurts, and you can just sit through it. You can just sit still. So what I found is that I get to decide how to respond to it. My preference is always that my legs not hurt. But I found that if I can let go of it, something else arises. This was, you know, very early and this very basic, but it was a huge revelation for me. I mean, what I got from that is that I don't have to be pushed around by my reactions moment to moment. If I can let go of my reactions to my butt being sore, or to somebody cutting me off into traffic, or to my teenage daughter pushing every button I have, something else emerges. The unique breeze of reality. Things as it is. So, you know, in some sense, that's the entirety of our practice. The more dramatic version of that is of the founder of our school, Dongshan, the story about him being that in his monastery, a monk came to him and said, you know, this place has got terrible insulation. I'm embroidering a little. You know, in the winter, it's so cold that it's hard to sit. In the summer, I get so hot that it's unbearable. What do I do about the heat and the cold? And Dongshan said, when it's hot, die in the heat. When it's cold, die in the cold. So that's a little daunting, don't you think? Die in the heat, die in the cold. But, you know, what he's pointing to is letting the reaction, letting the sense of self that's attached to that reaction, just letting it go, let it die. See what grows. So I found a sort of a toolkit, a group of practices known as the paramitas, or the perfections, that have been infinitely helpful to me personally in dealing with that daunting dying in the heat and dying in the cold. In our tradition, we generally count six of these perfections. Dana, generally translated as generosity. Shila, which is unfortunately translated as morality, but I prefer upright conduct. Virya, which is often effort or energy. Kshanti, patience or tolerance. Jhana, which for these purposes is just meditation. And prajna, the prajna paramita. We at the end of the echo, of our dedication this morning, when we offered what the merit of what we're doing to our great teachers and to the Maha Prajna Paramita, to the perfection of Prajna, wisdom. These perfections are said to be the qualities of a bodhisattva. Or one of my closest friends that is a teacher in the Vipassana tradition, where they don't bother so much with bodhisattvas. He describes them as the aspects of the Buddha. I think more to the point for us is that cultivating these qualities is an enormous support to our own efforts to be free. So I could easily spend all day today and maybe all week talking about the six perfections. But I'm sure if I did that, our legs would really hurt, and we'd really prefer to be doing something else. So I'm going to touch just very briefly on a few aspects of these paramitas that I found specifically helpful in this work of letting go. Nico was kind enough to loan me her glasses, which both work and don't, so I'm taking them on and off. So the first is dana, and I think you all know about the practice of dana, of generosity, putting some money in the basket to support Jokoji, to support your teachers. You know about generosity in terms of helping the less fortunate. But there is perhaps an even more fundamental form of giving, which is namely giving up our really narrow view of who we are and giving up our preferences. In doing that, generosity begins at home. Dogen, I get to call everybody our founder. Dogen was the founder of our school in Japan. Great teacher. We also, I think, paid homage to him. Said, you should know that to give to yourself is part of giving. So one really important aspect of dana is being patient with yourself when you find yourself distracted in your mindfulness, when you find yourself clinging to your preferences. Suzuki Roshi used to talk about grandmother mind. He talked about parents, you know, little child's running around screaming and, you know, throwing her toys everywhere and, it sounds more like a little boy, actually, throwing his toys everywhere and making an enormous mess. And parents are like, what are you doing? Don't do that. And, you know, the grandmother in Suzuki Roshi's telling you, saying, isn't that cute? So whether or not that's true of grandmothers or grandfathers, the notion is there that when we are facing, as I think we all do, the intense self-criticism that comes with feeling like we're not doing this practice right. You know, I counted my breath for up to four, and then I lost it completely, and I was off somewhere else. Why did I lose my temp? You know, I'm just a terrible Zen student. Grandmother mind. You know, isn't that cute? It's, you know, just seeing the sincerity of your effort. Giving yourself credit, this is really important. When you do, when you make it here on a Sunday, when you sit as much as you can sit, when you are generous, be generous to yourself. Feeling good about that, even for a moment, is so important to proceeding in practice. So the next paramita is Shila, conducting yourself in upright fashion. And that, there again, we could just talk a whole lot about that, about the precepts, about the teachings, about how to do that. But instead, I'm just going to say this. To me, this teaching of Shila, these precepts, are not about being a good person, particularly. They're not about being admirable. Those things are very nice. They tend to follow from acting right. To me, being upright, acting properly towards others and towards the environment, it's fundamentally about getting out of our own way. Do you know who Alan Watts is? Any of you read Alan Watts? I have all these like dated references, you know. But years and years ago, a lot of us found our way into spiritual practice through Alan Watts. He wrote an autobiography called In My Own Way, which this one functions on at least three levels that I can count. The way, of course, being the Tao. In my own way being the common way of saying, you know, this is just how I did it. And also, he got in his own way an awful lot. By, you know, not really according with the precepts, I think. And he saw it. He saw how hard it is to free our minds. How hard it is to free our minds if we're killing. That may seem obvious, but I represent people. What I do for a living is represent people who've killed other people. I'm a lawyer. I represent people on death row. And I get to see how thoroughly they've made a problem for themselves. Not just practically, but spiritually. You know, I get to see their poignant struggle to dig out of the hole that they've dug themselves. So that's an extreme case. But stealing, getting stoned or gossiping, abusing our sexuality, maybe these are things that are a little more familiar to most of us. All of those things were about clinging to our preferences, and they all get in our way. So, upright behavior. The third of the paramitas is, this is my all-time favorite of the perfections. Preferences. Kshanti, which is translated most often as patience, sometimes as tolerance. Most literally, it means being able to bear it. This is what we're practicing when we notice the pain in our legs and let it go, when we don't get into it with the guy who cut us off on the freeway, and when we find ourselves going off to Kalamazoo when we're trying to meditate. And instead of berating ourselves for being such lousy Zen students, we say, oh, how adorable, and return to our breath. Maybe we don't even do the extra, oh, how adorable, but it's okay. The sages talk about three levels of Kshanti practice. The capacity to tolerate what's termed personal suffering, our painful thighs, or the loss of a loved one. Second is the capacity to put up with other people. The guy on the freeway. And then the third, the most profound level, is the capacity to tolerate the truth of reality. This is Anuttapatika Dharma Kashanti. So that last one is really interesting to me. My experience is that no matter how deeply I settle into meditation, and, you know, I've done enough of it that at times, you know, it's gotten kind of deep, there is almost always a constant, very quiet and subtle hum of anxiety. And it's the anxiety of not knowing, what is it? What is this? I mean, that's just my own experience. So, Anuttapatika Dharma Kashanti is being patient with that anxiety, being patient with the not knowing. I think the last time I was here, I told this story about the teacher Dijong and his student, Fayan. Fayan was leaving the monastery, and Dijong asked, where are you going? Fayan said, I'm going around on pilgrimage. Dijong asked, what is the purpose of pilgrimage? Aside, in the old days in China, you know, monks would go traveling hundreds of miles by foot to go from one monastery to another to see teachers, pilgrimage. What is the purpose of pilgrimage? Fayan said, I don't know. Dijong said, not knowing is nearest. Not knowing is most intimate. So intimacy is wonderful, but intimacy can be difficult to stand. Anuttapatika Dharma Kashanti, this most profound aspect of the paramita, of the perfection, is learning to tolerate that intimacy, learning to tolerate not knowing. I propose that if we can really do that, we can also readily tolerate the more mundane things that cause us pain, that grind our gears. The things that lead us to react rather than to respond. The sage Shanti Deva said, beyond being without fear of what is ultimately true, there is no other tolerance. Beyond being without fear of what is ultimately true, there is no other tolerance. So to me, that's really the root of it. We're talking about, well, why really do I resist living in the truth of reality? Because it involves not knowing. It involves that intimacy. And it's very hard to bear. It takes great patience. It all flows from the practice of paying attention and being willing to tolerate what you're feeling right now and trusting that you can. So doing this, of course, requires effort, but a certain kind of effort. I'm on to the next of the perfections, the paramita of virya, which is translated as effort, or energy, or sometimes as zeal. Virya is an interesting word. Its root is the warrior spirit. And it's the same root that gave a rise to various words that we have, vigor and vitality and, for better or worse, virility. The greatest challenge for most people in practice is how to keep doing it. This is obviously true within the period of meditation itself. Practicing mindfully, we might catch a reaction rising, an impulse to avoid having to feel what we're feeling. We notice that our mind is going instead to all the things we need to do, things that have happened. We maybe feel hurt or sit there just bathed in shame. With kshanti, with patience, we let it go, which is great. But in the next moment, our mind is hopped on the express train to Sheboygan, and we have to do it all over again. I don't know, does this sound familiar to you?
Sheboygan does.
Yeah, that one was for you. That one was, we're in the upper Midwest here. It's our teacher's homeland. So this is where virya comes in. And there's the problem of getting ourselves to meditate again the next day and the next, and this is really hard. If you're sitting regularly or even kind of regularly, again, you should feel good about that. The teacher Aiken Roshi said, virya, like patience, like sincerity, like inquiry, like samadhi, builds with practice. As my teacher used to say, 5% is enough to start with. If you have enough vitality and stick-to-itiveness to sit through 25 minutes of meditation, you have quite a bit of spiritual zeal. Well, I think you all already sat through way more than 25 minutes this morning, so virya is there. So, you know, honestly, when I was studying the paramitas, and I've studied them a bunch, this is the one that had the least resonance for me. Okay, you have to put your shoulder to the wheel, or more precisely, your butt on the cushion. I found it more helpful when Norman Fisher described it as joyful effort. But still, this really opened up for me when I was looking into the practice of breath counting, which is something else that I've had an ambivalent relationship with. Do you talk about breath counting here? Oh. Well, when I first came to the San Francisco Zen Center, they taught breath counting. You just count your breaths. 1 to 10. Generally, you know, on the inhale or the exhale. I think the way that it was taught there, count on the exhale. 1, 2. You get to 10, start again at 1. You lose your way, you start again at 1. I learned that at one point Suzuki Roshi instructed everyone in his sangha to stop trying to do whatever they were doing and just count their breaths. I think people had a lot of far-out ideas about what Zazen was. Okay, stop, you know. pulled the cord, stop. We're just going to count our breaths. It is particularly, you know, I found if you're agitated or whatever, it's really a great way to find some center. But after a while, I found it became too easy for it to become automatic, sort of a background track while my mind kept wandering, you know? 1. Oh no, did I remember to pay the parking ticket? 2. Let's see, I got it while I was waiting for Doris. 3, I still can't believe what she said to me. 4. So the breath counting can even feel like kind of a trap. So it's helpful to have it as support. And we most commonly find support for our practice in paying our attention to our breathing. And breath counting is a good way into that. Recently, I offered the practice to my sitting group. And afterwards, one of the students came to me and said how much it helped. So I decided to look into it more. And I read everything that Suzuki Roshi said about it. There's the wonders of our age. All of Suzuki Roshi's lectures are the ones that were recorded, and that's a lot of them, are archived. You can actually word search, you know. So I word searched for breath counting and found that what he stressed over and over is that it's not just a matter of counting, which is what I'd been doing. It's something you do with every part of your body and mind. He said, when you count your breathing, it's very simple to count from 1 to 10. But each breathing should be, you know, on each breathing, all of your mind and body should participate. With whole body and mind, you take one breathing. With whole body and mind. For me, this is the secret sauce. It's not just doing the thing automatically, perhaps grudgingly. It is engaging in counting the breaths, engaging in whatever you're doing, meditating, driving a car, doing your work, wholeheartedly with your whole body and mind, whatever the task is. I found that when I make an effort with that thought, with that intention, the entire flavor of what I'm doing changes. It really feels different than the grinding effort that I'm used to making. My experience is that when I practice with my whole body and mind, whatever it is I'm doing, meditating, washing the dishes, I experience something like what Norman was referring to, joyful effort. Not that I'm actually sitting there doing backflips, but there becomes a lightness and an ease, even a kind of sweetness to my energy. It's true in whatever I'm doing. The fifth of the paramitas is jhana, concentration, technically. But in this context, it refers more generally to meditation. And this has some special resonance for us. Jhana is the word translated into Chinese as chana or chan, translated into Japanese zen. This is what we do, jhana. This is our practice of zazen, the practice of letting go over and over, of trusting the not knowing. So I think everyone in this room knows that that's much easier said than done. Our little minds resist like crazy. And so the jhana paramita, the perfection of meditation, relies on all of the other paramitas, on being patient, on being generous with ourselves, on being upright, on our joyful effort, and generosity most of all. And all of these practices are in turn made possible by the final one, the prajna paramita. So the Sanskrit word prajna is almost invariably translated as wisdom. But the etymology of the word is very important. It's a combination of the words pra, meaning before, and jnya. Not so great with Sanskrit, which is the verb to know. It is before knowing. This sort of wisdom is not about knowing things. Have I gone on too long? This is a more fundamental form of understanding. This is the understanding that comes before knowing things. In fact, in some sense, it's the antithesis of knowing, because to know something necessarily involves reducing it to a thing, something separate from other things. Prajna Paramita teaches that this is a fundamentally inaccurate understanding of reality. Suzuki Roshi said, to call something a flower is a sin. Does that seem obscure? Do you understand what he's saying? You put a label on it and you have turned it into a thing instead of it's just experiencing its thusness. So what is a fundamentally accurate understanding? Well, not knowing is nearest. Of course, we know all kinds of things. We have to function in the world. Thus, we have the conventional or relative truth. But there is also what's referred to as the absolute truth, the highest meaning of the holy truths in another story. And that's the teaching of emptiness. And that's very much what's pointed to in the Xinxin Ming that we recited this morning. Before I go any further, though, I want to acknowledge how off-putting the term emptiness is. For many folks, emptiness sounds a lot like nihilism. My friend Daijaku Kintz refers to it as the most unfortunate translation of a Buddhist term into the English language. Personally, I think boundlessness is closer, and that's a more literal translation of the Chinese character for emptiness, ku, boundlessness.
Yeah, the translation of the Heart Sutra of Kaz Tanahashi.
Oh, really?
Uses that.
Yeah. Boundlessness. Yeah. I think it's closer to what's really being conveyed. That we really believe that each thing we encounter, the cushion, the bell, these robes, me, you, the venerable teacher, all exists as a separate entity. You know, and it's okay, it's even necessary to operate on that premise in getting through this life. But that conventional reality is just that, a convention. Recently, I did my very first Vipassana retreat. I did a retreat at Spirit Rock up in Marin County. And one evening, one of the teachers looked out on the happy assemblage of meditators. They referred to us as yogis. Looked out at the yogis and said, "Sometime, not that long from now, everyone in this room will be gone. And we call this reality." It just hit me like a ton of bricks. When I am meditating and I experience that very quiet anxiety I described, I sometimes think of a passage from T.S. Eliot's Four Quartets. "Go," said the bird, "for the leaves were full of children, hidden excitedly, containing laughter. Go, go, go," said the bird. "Humankind cannot bear very much reality." Time past and time future, what might have been and what has been, point to one end, which is always present. We believe that we cannot bear that much reality. We believe that. I believe, I have that belief. That's what I get anxious about. In a sense, the entire point, if you want to talk in those terms, the entire point of meditation is to train ourselves to bear this magnificent, indescribable, terrible, exquisite, constantly changing reality. Just for a moment. Then another, and another. We train our minds to incline towards thusness, to see things as it is. And we constantly remind ourselves just this. It's really a practice that I commend. Just bringing to mind just this. The unique breeze of reality. Do you see it? Continuously, creation runs her loom and shuttle, weaving the ancient brocade, incorporating the forms of spring. But nothing can be done about Manjushri's leaking. Well, you know, I'm sure not Manjushri, but I have been leaking a bit. Please forgive me. I sincerely urge you to forget everything I said. If some scrap of it turns out to be helpful to you, it'll appear. And before I go, I want to, if you don't mind a little more, I'll read you a poem by Pablo Neruda called Keeping Quiet. Do you all know this poem? I only learned of it recently, although I will love Pablo Neruda. Keeping quiet. Now we will count to 12, and we will all keep still. For once on the face of the earth, let's not speak in any language. Let's stop for a second and not move our arms so much. It would be an exotic moment, without rush, without engines. We would all be together in a sudden strangeness. Fishermen in the cold sea would not harm whales. And the man gathering salt would not look at his hurt hands. Those who prepare green wars, wars with gas, wars with fire, victories with no survivors, would put on clean clothes and walk about with their brothers in the shade, doing nothing. What I want should not be confused with total inactivity. Life is what it is about. If we were not so single-minded about keeping our lives moving, and for once could do nothing, perhaps a huge silence might interrupt this sadness of never understanding ourselves and of threatening ourselves with death. Now I'll count up to 12, and you keep quiet, and I will go.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.